observations before we proceed. Firstly, that Chapter 9 institutions are important institutions in our law, under our law and the constitutions, and they are independent, and the heads of these institutions must act without fear or favor or interference from anyone. And therefore, it is also important that no one, including ourselves, don't cast aspersions on the heads of Chapter 9 institutions or those institutions, because if we ourselves bring those institutions into disrepute, we will be undermining the democracy that they have been established to support and strengthen. So what has been in the media is disturbing, because the public protector has been forced to go to extent of saying that parliamentarians are interfering in her work. And that suggestion is a very serious suggestion, because it can be public representatives who interfere in the work of the public protector, which means that as public representatives, we need to look at ourselves and say, what is it that we do rightly or wrongly to lead the public protector to accuse us of interfering with her work? Because by doing so, we may be undermining that office and therefore putting that office into disrepute. What I know, and we should all know, is that in Parliament, there is an institution called the Forum for Institutions Supporting Democracy. And that if there are challenges, the heads of Chapter 9 institutions can meet in that forum under the chairpersonship of the Deputy Speaker to address whatever challenges they are there. Also, the law requires that the rules and policies table developed by the public protector should be tabled before Parliament. But there are processes that must be undertaken before that is done. I still have to be helped to understand why the rules and policies were not processed through that forum for institutions supporting democracy before. before they were referred to us, because no one is infallible. And I take the view, wrongly or rightly, that what is before us could have been processed through the existing mechanisms, including the Forum of Institutions Supporting Democracy, and whatever advisors, legal advisors, and political leaders in that forum think that they leave something to be desired. Those matters could have been resolved there, so that when these matters come to us, we really get confronted with trivial issues, which may create a situation where, as members of parliament, we may be seen by the public, which has to have confidence in Chapter 9 institutions, to be casting aspersions on the public protector. So I am very concerned that these matters are before us, and I take the view that these matters are not actually properly processed. But we have no choice, because these matters have been referred to us, and we have to deal with them. But I am unwillingly dealing with these matters. I'm unwillingly dealing with these matters because I think that before matters come to us, the appropriate structures like the Forum for Institutions Supporting Democracy must deal with them, satisfy them that those matters are ripe for table. And these matters, for me, are not ripe, but I don't have the authority not to deal with the matters. So I will raise these process matters with the powers that be, so that in future we don't find ourselves having to have a war of words with the public protector or any head of the Chapter 9 institution over whether or not we are interfering with their work or casting aspersions on her office, because that would not be consistent with our constitutional duty to entrench and deepen democracy. We need these institutions of supporting democracy, and I think as well we must also proceed from the premise that all human beings are fallible, and that's why appeals lie from the magistrate court to the high court, from the high court to the supreme court, from the supreme court to the concord, because even judges do make mistakes. So if we're looking for a democracy in which officials, however high the positions they are holding, will not err, that democracy, I think, we'll find in heaven and not on earth. So I'm just saying that when we deal with this matter, we must bear in mind what is it that we ourselves have done wrong to find ourselves in a situation where we are now. But that is a debate for another forum and another day. I'm just making those remarks because I'm reluctantly tabling this matter before yourselves, but the matter is a referral. Thank you very much.
Chair, I just need clarity on what matter you're exactly referring to, because I do understand that you might have concerns about Chapter 9 institutions, but they are accountable to Parliament. And so, Chair, we cannot allow our constitutional duties to be bypassed. We have to. The public protector is appointed by Parliament. And so in the exercise of our oversight, we have to hold all Chapter 9 institutions accountable. And so we cannot be neglectful of our duties. And so I'm not sure are you referring to the DA letter, that, because I would assume that is what you're referring to, and that you are, in other words, saying that another forum should have dealt with that, and I would or another process.
Let me correct you.
Yeah,
I'm saying that this matter that's before us, which are the rules, should have been processed elsewhere, and those who process them should have satisfied themselves before they refer them to us. And I've studied the rules and the policies, and I am of the view, wrongly or rightly, that that process was left much to be desired. So I'm not referring to...
I'm grateful for that clarity, Chair, but just your general comments about parliamentarians, I do understand, but we need to be cautious that we have a very important constitutional duty as members of Parliament, and whilst I appreciate that it might be someone's view that we might be interfering, but that would have to be motivated at the right time. But there's no ways that I, as a seasoned MP, will not exercise my oversight function whilst respecting the right of Chapter 9 institutions and their domain. But at the end of the day, they are accountable. But that's not what you were suggesting, Chair.
I'm not suggesting that, and I'm fully in agreement with you, but the fact that there is already a public debate over the parliamentary debate shows that there is a problem somewhere. But in the rightful forum, we'll have to deal with how did that situation arise, because it may be something that we ourselves are not doing properly, and in the exercise of our duty, we also have to do things properly. But as I say, that is a debate for another forum and for another day. Thank you. Advocate Nkweban, thank you for appearing before us. We requested you last week to appear before us. It may have been at short notice, because of our own parliamentary schedule, but this committee raised a concern about the short notice. You informed us after hours a day before that because of a family emergency, you were not available. And the committee was not happy about that. And secondly, the committee was not happy that you did not send your deputy to appear before us. And I think it would be fair to take the committee into your confidence why the short notice. It may be that some family matters you don't want to disclose. If you that is the case, say so. But why you didn't send your deputy is a question that the MPs would want to know. So if we can clear those before we go into the substance of our discussion.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you to honourable members. Chairperson, I would like to again apologize for not being able to make it on the 6th of June. And I've tried my best to attend because we've already made the arrangements. And again, the documentation, I took it because we sent it directly to the Speaker's office. Already the members of the committee will be having those documents. I couldn't send my deputy because I thought those issues, especially the issue of the rules and the issue of the policy of the special advisor, required my special attention. And I think I'll give the deputy also an opportunity to comment on this particular matter. But then again, Chairperson, I've written a letter to you dated the 8th of May or 18th of May explaining to you why I am not I have not been delegating certain duties to the Deputy Public Protector. You've received that letter. I think I've sent it yes to your office. So that was the reason why, in fact, even the last time when I was asked why I'm not delegating or why am I not with the Deputy Public Protector and why am I allocating certain responsibilities to the Deputy Public Protector, I think that's why I'm saying he can take the chairperson and the members of the committee into that explanation why that process happened the way it happened. So for me, I took it, it's that responsibility is not delegated to the Deputy Public Protector. Hence, I wanted to come myself to the members of the committee. And to me, it would have also appeared as if I'm not taking the committee seriously. So I wanted to be here myself to take the committee through the rules and the policy.
I received your letter only yesterday, and I'm convinced that from that letter there are good reasons why you did not delegate your deputy to come and deal with these matters. And I would therefore suggest that we don't put the deputy into the dock about that. It's a matter that we will address at another level. But for today, I think we should focus on the rules before us. And I think also that the past is past. You have apologized. And if we take this time to debate the apology, it is not going to take us anywhere. We should actually just deal with the matters before us, and I hope the honourable members will understand that. Honourable Horn.
Yes, Chair, thank you. I have a bit of an unease with respect for you as the Chair to make the decision that the letter and the contents of the letter is sufficient for on behalf of the committee to ease any uncertainties or answer any uncertainties we might have in respect of the delegated powers of the Deputy Public Protector. With the greatest of respect to you, I don't think it's a call only you could make. That is a matter that needs to be aired here in committee.
I say that because there is a forum of institution supporting democracy, and they are aware of the letter written by the public protector, and that letter should have been processed there, and the institution did not process that letter. So I will come back with a report to this committee on that letter. But for today, I think the letter is not processed, and I'm in no position to raise the issues in that letter.
Thank you. I'm over here. There you go. The letter has not been distributed to the committee members. Is there a reason for that? We'd like to see it, please. And secondly, the institution for oversight that you're referring to is not the oversight body for the Office of the Public Protector. This committee is. And so I think that matter should be debated here.
I'm not sure if we really do have enough time to deal with macro-managing the public project. We don't know the letter. The explanation that was given was that there are reasons for this. Are we now investigating the reasons? Is this part of it? Because what has happened is that the public protector, if I heard it correctly, I apologize for this, but there are these reasons that I couldn't do it. Now, are we really, what is the end result of that particular inquiry? What do we want to achieve with that particular inquiry? That's the point. I think that, Honorable Chair, let's just carry on with the business of today. We go through the rules, go to whatever is supposed to be done now. With due respect, I thank you.
Yeah, no. thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And greetings to colleagues. And also to the public protector and the team and everybody in the house. Yeah, well, Chair, I think our concern in the previous meeting, it was on the issue of delegation. I think we understood that the public protector sent an apology that there's an emergency, family emergency. So, but then our concern was that why there's no delegation. But now that the public protector has indicated that the issue, the fact that she did not delegate the deputy in the previous meeting of the 6th, it was based on the fact that there's a letter that she has written in May explaining why she is unable to delegate some of the responsibility to the deputy, a letter which has not served in the committee. So I think we should also accept that I think there's an omission maybe on the part of the secretariat. It should have, even before the last week's meeting, have tabled, put that letter into the program of the committee, so that the committee look at the letter, look at the reason. So unfortunately, when we said last week, we were not, as members of this committee, were not aware of that letter. So now that there's an issue of the letter, and there are reasons on the letter, and the letter that we have not seen as members, so I think it would be unfair, I think, now to say maybe that we don't agree with the content of the letter when we have not even looked at the letter. So for now, I think we should take the apology of the public protector, and then I think in another meeting have time to to deal with that particular letter, look at the reasons why there's no delegation to the Deputy Public Protector. For now, I would also align myself with Honorable Mulan to say, let's carry on with the meeting. Let's accept the apology, carry on with the meeting. Then in another meeting, we'll look at that particular letter. Then say.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, we must start from what transpired last week. To be honest, the mood last week. As a committee, we felt very much disrespected by the public protector and her office. We must be fair. And as Honorable Skhosana and some of my colleagues have alluded to relating the issue of the public protector herself not sending any delegation from office. And the late apology at around 5 o'clock, a day before the meeting, as you reported to the committee chairperson with due respect, we felt very much disrespected by the public protector. We must be clear on that. And it's true, as this committee, we were not informed as to why the public protector did not send a delegation. And regarding that letter, which is being referred to, dated 18 May this year. So, Chairperson, I don't know if really the public protector is showing remorse on that, or is she really apologizing. If the committee thinks the apology then is accepted, then we can then move and let her make her presentation. But on a very serious note, those who were present on that meeting last week, we felt very much disrespected.
No, Chair, I associate myself with the previous speaker that we do, and I said last week that we do understand that family emergencies take place, and I would have liked to know and understand that you've now ascertained, and there is obviously a degree of privacy in those issues as well, and you've ascertained that it was justifiable, and we accept that, and we also accept the public protector's report, but maybe it would be good if it was a matter of great privacy, that we could, in private, just have an understanding of that family emergency, but we respect that could also be an issue of privacy. But I am concerned about the letter of the 18th of May, and I presume it was addressed to us as a committee or elsewhere, and we maybe should have had sight of that so that we could understand the issues around delegation as well. It is, as Ms. Motopo has said, that we felt disrespected last week. And I think that, but we need to move forward, I suppose. We've accepted the public protector has given an apology, and but it would be helpful for us just to get that letter of the 18th of May as soon as possible. Thank you, Chair.
I equally felt disrespected, and I avoided going to the media. I was invited to the media to respond to what the public protector said, but I felt that I cannot go and debate with the public protector in the media because there are other forums where I can engage with her, and this is the forum. But in this forum, I am convinced that, family emergencies are different in degrees and in nature. Some of them may be so confidential that you cannot disclose. I'm prepared to accept that there was a family emergency. Emergencies don't give notice when they arise. And the letter that she sent on time, on the 18th of May, I received after hours yesterday. I have not yet found out why a letter sent on the 18th of May only came to my attention yesterday after hours. And that is a matter that I will deal with in the right forum. So I think that I will come back to this committee to give you a full report of what happened, but I don't want to deal with matters that have not been properly processed, because as I said, we have a responsibility not to unnecessarily cast aspersions on the office of any head of Chapter 9 institution, because these institutions were established by the Constitution to support and strengthen our democracy, and we still need to entrench and deepen this democracy, and we must keep party politics out of our discussions. And I want to agree with you, Honorable Swart, that it would serve our purpose for today that we proceed with the business before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps you would be so kind as to disseminate the letter of the 18th of May, since you now have it and we don't. We can find out what the reasons for its late arrival were later, but I'm sure all the committee members would like to see it. I most certainly would, so perhaps we could get it now. And while it's very admirable that you restrained yourself from going to the media, as you say, we should all remember that the public protector herself felt no such restraint. And on the night that she didn't appear in Parliament in the morning, she felt it was fine to go on national television and slate this committee. I'd like some explanation about that from the public protector. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think we can move forward with the business of the day, but we must put it in record that the apology by the public protector is not accepted, because we don't have the document for the reason of not delegating the deputy public protector until further notice. Thank you, Chairperson.
I think the majority of the committee members feel that we must proceed. And I want to make the undertaking that I will come back with a report on the contents of the letter, because I want to process it properly to ensure that, firstly, that letter is authentic, secondly, that we don't cast aspersion on any Chapter 9 institution unfairly. And I think we must now proceed. Honorable Mpumlwana, I actually am not inclined to open this matter.
I just wanted to make it clear. I think, I don't know whether Ndatemla was when you were saying that he's not accepting, because I think most other people have said that we accept the apology and just carry on.
Right.
Just that part.
No, I think it's right, because you don't accept something that we have not seen. Yeah, he's right. I agree with him. So we proceed. When I come back to make the report, then everybody will be empowered to accept or reject. But for today, people are not qualified to take a decision. I will send it at the appropriate time. Thank you very much. Yeah. Advocate Nkweman, may you proceed, please, and make your presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members, I've brought the CEO, Mr. Masangu, the Deputy Public Protector, Mr. Advocate Kevin Malunga, Mr. Niels van der Merwe, one of the senior investigators, but who's responsible for knowledge management, and has been working for years on the issue of rules, and Mr. Opa Sekgalwe, the spokesperson of the Public Protector. Chairperson, I'd like to open by saying the rules were deliberated in full in 2010 by this committee, I'll allow the CEO to present, but then just to give a background that the rules were published in a government gazette in 29 November 2010, and were presented to the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services 27 February 2012. And there were extensive engagements with the Department of Justice and the branch legislative drafting and the chief state law advisors. There were internal workshops and consultations then, and there was a final draft verified by state law advisors. So the Public Protector Act requires tabling and promulgation on government gazette. So that's what the Public Protector Act requires. So currently what we've done, we've tabled the rules with the speaker, and after tabling, there was a noting which we've received from the clerk responsible for accepting that particular process. But I note the chairperson's concern about the forum to deliberate on this particular rules, because I think that is for the speaker's office to determine. But then I must indicate that these rules were deliberated on, and currently we have then incorporated the comments by the state law advisors, and then we've tabled them, but we didn't go ahead and publish them again for that process, because we wanted that we receive the noting of the rules by the National Assembly. So I'll allow the CEO to take the committee through the rules, and then we can deliberate on that process.
Thank you, Public Protector. Proceed.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Thanks, Honourable Members, Public Protector and colleagues. I will first take you through what we normally call the table of contents, the overview of the document. Starting with the process to date, the purpose of the rules themselves, lodging complaint with the Public Protector, processing of complaint lodged with the Public Protector, general aspects relating to investigation of complaint lodged with the office, conducting preliminary investigation, compliance with information request, and timelines of Public Protector, conducting of proceedings before Public Protector, general aspect in resolving complaints, conclusions of complaints, general provisions, observations, then and questions. The rules in respect of Section 7-11 of Public Protector Act 23 of 1994, the rules in respect of matters referred to is Section 7, which has a bearing on and are incidental to the investigation by the Public Protector. So basically, these rules were, as the Public Protector has alluded, has been clarified with the Chief State Law Advisor. Now, she has already mentioned, but I'll just repeat this slides four, where the how the process unfolded. Published for public comments, which was Government Gazette, there's a number there, of 29 November 2010, and then presented to the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services, 27 February 2012. There was also extensive engagements with the Department of Justice, branch, legislative, drafting, chief state law advisor, also internal workshop that was also part of the consultation, and then final draft verified by the chief state law advisor. The Public Protector Act requires tabling, noting, and promulgation on the government gazette, which I've already said. The next slide talks to the chapters. There's several chapters. We'll go through them one by one. The first chapter basically deals, like any other document, deals with the definitions to supplement and clarify matters described in the Act and the Constitution, solely to describe for clarity. For example, what is the complainant, who's complaining, a party's state institution. So that's basically that. Then chapter two, the purpose of the rules, is basically to enhance access and promote efficiency of investigation through procedures for how to lodge a complaint, resolution of disputes, service standards in conducting investigations, timelines for the taking of actions, time frame for organs of state to respond to a report or findings, steps to be taken for non-adherence with timelines. So this one is straightforward. Then the next chapter talks about lodging complaint with the public protector. Here we look at who can report a matter or lodge a complaint, manner, orally, writing, form, online, or walk-in, depending on how the person would like to lodge a complaint. Information required when reporting matter or lodging a complaint. What the public protector can investigate and resolve. Confidentiality matters or confidentiality of information, format of reporting a matter or lodging a complaint, manner of submitting a matter or complaint to the public protector, place of reporting a matter or lodging a complaint. So here we are basically saying that a person may lodge a complaint with the public protector. It could be orally, by complainant can complete the form, or it can be online or in writing by means of a letter. All that is explained in the rules. Still on that chapter, delivery of documents and notices, procedure followed after reporting a matter or lodging complaint, especially those within 2 years prescribed, procedure followed after reporting a matter or lodging a complaint outside the prescribed time period later than prescribed 2 years, information that is would be necessary or required. Then the issue of refusal by the public protector to investigate. What will be the grounds, reasons to complainants, remedy, advising complainant about appropriate remedies, referral of complaint to or by public bodies or other authorities. Requirements to be deemed delivered by hand or registered post. This is just a repetition of what I've said before. So I'll move to the next slide. So chapter 5 will basically detail the general aspects relating to investigations of complaint lodged with the public protector. Here we'll deal with the format, procedure of investigation, which is also detailed in section 7.1 of the Public Protector Act, has discretion, hence sub-rule 10 of that act. Reporting of state institution to execute authorities or parliament, legal assistance during investigation, circumstances under which public protector will request assistance from other state institutions, format and procedure followed in respect of own initiative investigation, informing parties of assistance by the state institution. Then we'll move to chapter 6, conducting the preliminary investigation, deciding on preliminary investigation, every case or inform the complainant, time frame for conducting preliminary investigation, i.e. 30 days, procedure after conclusion of preliminary investigation, decline of investigation, conduct of investigation, resolve or rectify or omission or early resolution or alternative dispute resolution, sorry, and refer or advise to other bodies. Then chapter 7 deal with compliance with information requests and timelines of the public protector. Responsibility of state institution to cooperate with the public protector, attaining cooperation during investigation unless otherwise determined by the public protector, acknowledgement, which is basically 3 days after the lodgement of the complaint, substantive reply, which is 14 days on EMEA, and then substantive reply to others, which is 30 days, and substantive reply, which is section 79, which is 10 days once it's issued. The reminder, and then that comes later in 7 days. Direct request to executive authority or HODs, designated people in the state institution, refusal or failure to cooperate with the public protector, section 9 of the Public Protector Act, or contempt in case there was no response to the designated person. Contempt of the public protector or report the matter to other bodies like SAPS and apply to the High Court in terms of the motion of proceedings. Chapter 8, basically, it's conducting of proceedings before the public protector, alternative dispute resolutions or hearing. the circumstances here define the circumstances under which the public protector conducts the proceedings, the notices of hearing, failure of party to participate in the proceedings, how we deal with that, person allowed to attend the proceedings, nature of the proceedings, procedures before commencement of proceedings, procedures at commencement of proceedings, and procedures during proceedings. Conditions for joining, substituting, or adding parties to proceedings and consolidations of complaints, if necessary. Then the general aspect in resolving complaints. The chapter deals with the method of resolving a complaint, which is read with Section 6 of the Public Protector Act, the mediation process to conciliate, to negotiate, facilitation of resolutions, express an opinion, advice on appropriate course of action, and implementation of resolution, basically in case of settlement. Then Chapter 10, Conclusion of a Complaint. This basically deals with how a conclusion is reached on a complaint, which is the matters that affect whether it's resolved, closing of the report, formal report into Section 82B, Constitution Section 82B of the PPA Act, affording opportunity to complainant to make representation before finalizing the complaint, adverse findings of the public protector, monitoring of agreement and remedial action to be taken, grounds for requesting internal review. So here, the complaint is concluded if the matter is resolved by means of mediation, conciliation or negotiations, and a settlement agreement has been signed. When the public protector reports his or her findings in terms of the section 8.1. The chapter 11 is basically the general provisions, recording of proceedings and investigation, what needs to happen during the investigation, language used during proceedings and investigations, contact particulars of public protector and customer service, short title and commencement. Then the next slides will basically talk to the annexures that goes with the investigation, which will be the contact details of the office, the complainant form, and then the subpoena. I will end here and give it to the PV to explain the next slide.
That's it.
Thank you, Chairperson. There were issues which were raised by the committee in the previous meeting of the 17th of April relating to the rules. Whether the rules are aligned to the judgment which was issued in the Public Protector versus Melin Guardian and other jurisprudence. That would want to indicate that indeed the rules are aligned to that case and the constitutional imperatives as well as universally accepted standards. So limitation in terms of expansion on original complaint, we are reviewing our handbook, especially on conducting administrative investigations, and we do have standard operating procedures where we are making sure that we are expeditious and we are very responsible to reporting to complainants about the investigations, because currently our standard operating procedures requires us to update the complainants every 6 weeks, and then we also make sure that there is a prioritization of executive members ethics act matters. Those ones, the provision is that we must finalize them within 30 days. Unfortunately, most of the time, due to work pressures, we are unable to do that. So Rule 24.2b provides for shorter time frames within which we expect a response from that executive which is implicated. So I think I was just clarifying the issues which were raised by the members of the committee the previous time. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable members, there is a presentation and explanation on matters which you had raised. They've been clarified. Can we then take hands? Honourable Mutapo, Honorable Lahon, proceed, Honorable Mutabu.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, TP.
Honorable Breidenbach, you are fully recognized this one.
Okay, for the present. For the presentation.
But if you point to the west instead of point upwards, I don't know whether you are raising your hands or not.
Am I recognized, Chairperson? Okay, thank you. The rules we are talking about, you said they were deliberated in full in 2010 by Justice Committee, and were published on the 29th of November the same year. There were extensive consultations. And then what I would like to know, Chairperson, through you, Chairperson, is since 2010 up to May this year, were the rules never implemented or what? What transpired? Why did it take such a very long time for these rules to be, if not implemented? Because the public protector says the tabling and whatever was done by the speaker, yes, that is noted. And what we would like to know is the issue of extensive consultation. What is she referring to in that regard? And then as to what I also like to know is, will these rules improve efficiency of their workings? And if so, what has been, or if not so, whatever response, what has been, in the meantime, lacking in their doings? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I also want to address the fact that these rules were drafted in 2010 already. And I think what needs to be addressed, Chair, is the fact that we now sit with a situation that the promotion of just administrative acts, the act of work, was also promulgated in the meantime. So we sit with the situation now that in the recent past, the High Court in the APSA CX matter made specific findings that the public protector did not follow an administrative fair process during the investigation. So now the question begs, A, was the rules properly followed during that investigation? And if that is the case, then we must conclude that the rules are not compliant with PAJA. Or we need information then to say the rules were not followed in that specific case, and that of course will lead to a whole lot of other questions. But for now, I think we need to be addressed, given the fact that there is substantial court findings on the processes followed by the public protector in that regard, whether their own rules were followed during that investigation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. And I would like to, I'm covered largely by Honourable Horn, but I'd like to ask the public protector with regards to these rules. I don't see a lot about, I see a lot about how people should respond to the public protector, but I don't see a lot about how the public protector should respond to people. And we know that there have been many complaints lodged with this committee and elsewhere that they get no response from the public protector and that they wait a long time for a response if they're lucky enough to get one. So I'd like some view on why that isn't part of these rules.
Issue of languages, Chairperson, will these rules be made in all official languages and put also on your website? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Yeah, I think I see that, I think they've indicated that there's been, I mean, the rules have been subjected to extensive public consultation. I just want to know which method they've used to consult the public. Two, on the rules, it appears that on the manner of submitting complaints, I think it does not appear to include the emails. If a person, whether is it the email, one of the methods that you can use to submit complaints. And lastly, according to clause 49, it says that a person dissatisfied with the services of the PPSA may approach customer care services at head office. I assume that a person who is dissatisfied with the an office of the PPSA at a certain area may approach customer care services at head office. However, there are no details that are given in terms of the follow-up processes and the response times and stuff like that. Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Advocate Nkwalan.
Thank you, Chairperson. The rules as to what had transpired, Honorable Mutapo, since 2010 till this day is that the rules as provided for in terms of the Public Protector Act operate similar to the issue of regulations. So what we had internally, there's a handbook on investigations, there's service standards which we are using internally, and as well there is standard operating procedures to make sure that all our 18 offices are operating in a similar manner. Whether this will improve efficiency and whether what has been lacking before, it will improve efficiency because if we've published the rules, and again you are indicating that we should be publishing them in all the languages, therefore we will also have a very robust expectations from members of the public or the complainants who would know what are the service standards of the public protector, because currently they are not there in the website, though I've been saying we should have placed them long time ago so that people will know that if I've lodged a complaint, an early resolution should be taking how many days, a complex matter should be taking how long. Therefore, definitely it will improve the issue of complainants holding us accountable as public protector employees and even the public protector. Honorable Horn, the issue of the badger, which was promulgated, and the decision of APSA that the public protector didn't follow the processes of fairness, I would like to indicate to you that there is a Supreme Court of Appeal judgment after that APSA matter, where the Supreme Court of Appeal, in a matter with Home Affairs, they've confirmed that the public protector is assessed based not on badger but on legality. Therefore, I'll share the details of that particular case. And it means we were following the Public Protector Act and the rules as provided for. So, Honorable Breitenbach, the issue of how PP should respond to people, it is there in the rules. I will request the CEO or Niels just to go directly to which rules provides for that. And because, as I'm saying, our service standards indicate that we should be updating the complainant every 6 weeks, which is internally being used. But then I just want us to refer you to the paragraph or to the article which deals with the time frame. And Honorable Skosana, what process was used to consult? Again, during that process, 2010, we had Niels. Can you also, if it's allowed, Chairperson, for him just to take the members, because he's been with the institution for very long time, so is our institutional memory as far as this process is concerned. Nils, can you go ahead?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair and honourable members. Yes, the rules were promulgated and then published in the Government Gazette at the time as drafts. We received comments and submissions from many state departments and those bodies that are subject to the public protector rules. At the time, the rules were more or less ready for promulgation. There were some issues that were outstanding that the public protector raised with the state law advisors. That took a process, and then other priorities in the office overtook the prioritization of the rules. One of the main issues was around the issue of contempt of the public protector, because we also engaged the NPA at the time to find out if there was a process, because the Act mainly provided for criminal action in respect of contempt of the public protector, and we were considering alternative methods similar to ex facie contempt in a court of law. So the issue of contempt, until the point where we reached an agreement that we would be able to also deal with contempt outside the criminal process in terms of the High Court rules, took some time. And then towards the end of the previous PP's tenure, the time was just not there to finalize it. Also, if I might mention the issue of capacity inside the office too, because this was delegated through various processes inside the office and some of the people left, so there were some operational issues affecting the promulgation of the rules until the public protector, Advocate Mkhwebane, prioritized it as one of the matters that needed to be finalized in terms of our strat plan. The consultation was external with all major government departments. All the submissions that we received at the time on processes and procedures were taken into account. State departments were not very happy about, for instance, timelines that were imposed, and therefore at the time, and also ourselves, needed to make it practical so that we can be held accountable and adhere to our own rules. So the issue of a discretion, but also to the purpose of the rules is to make, not only to regulate, but also to inform government departments as to the processes that a public protector follows. Because even at this late stage of the existence of the public protector, we still get responses from departments that refer to our complainants as our clients, as if we are spokespersons or representatives. So it is important for the rules to reflect a transparent process, also that the state knows that what processes we are going through, and many of them that were affected. We also, in the consultation process recently, submitted the rules through to FOSAT, so that the DGs at that level can also take note of the rules. And the aim with making the timelines now is also to explain the consequences of what will happen if the timelines are not adhered to. Because as the Act said, and as the investigation stood, we had to follow vigorous processes if we wanted to escalate matters, including to this committee.
I didn't read the judgment that you are referring to. When the courts say you are not subject to PAJA but to legality, what do they mean?
Okay, Chairperson, the matter is just SCA judgment in the matter between Home Affairs and the Public Protector. It was delivered on the 15th of March 2018, where the SCA, in fact, let me just take you through the their interpretation.
The citation.
Okay, it's 308 of 2017, and then ZASCA. Yes, that they held the following factors distinguish the decisions of the public protector from decisions of an administrative nature. First, the Office of the Public Protector is a unique institution designed to strengthen constitutional democracy. It does not fit into the institutions of public administration, but stands apart from them. Secondly, it is purpose-built watchdog that is independent and answerable to the National Assembly and not to any branch of government. Thirdly, although the State Liability Act 20 of 1957 applies to the Office of the Public Protector to enable it to sue and be sued, it is not a department of state and is functionally separate from state administration. It is only an organ of state because it exercises constitutional power, so they were just distinguishing it. Fourthly, its function is not to administer, but to investigate, report on, and remedy maladministration. Therefore, the Public Protector is given broad discretionary powers as to what complaints to accept and what allegations of maladministration to investigate, how to investigate them, and what remedial action to order, as close as one can get. So in this SCA judgment, the budget does not apply to the review of exercises of power by the Public Protector in terms of Section 182 of the Constitution and Section 6 of the Public Protector Act. In fact, in that judgment, the court indicated further that the court finds that in terms of Section 6.2c of PAJA, this conduct by the Public Protector was procedurally unfair. Therefore, the remedial action, paragraph 7, in fact, that is a judgment in the APSA matter, which it was saying. But then in this particular instance, the court in the SCA found that the Public Protector's powers or the Public Protector's investigations, PAJA, this SCA held that PAJA does not apply to the review of exercise of power by the Public Protector in terms of Section 182 of the Constitution and Section 6 of the Public Protector Act. So that's why I was saying I can give the citation here.
Jay, we note this judgment, but I think the answer I pose still remains the same. If I, for example, go to this very judgment the Public Protector has now referred to in paragraph 38, sorry, the SCA specifically said that ultimately in assessing whether the Public Protector followed a due and fair process during an investigation, it's immaterial whether the source or the guidelines are to be found in PAJA or based on the essential requirements of legality. Because both are stemming from our common law, asking for a fair and due process, and in the case of PAJA, it is just codified and applicable to governmental institutions, which the court then says the Public Protector is not part of. So the question I posed with respect still remains a valid question, namely, the Public Protector has now been found by our courts not to follow a fair process. Now the question remains, this is 2010 rules. Have they re-looked at the rules now after having been found by our courts not to have followed a fair process, or were the rules not followed during these investigations? Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to add on to the question of the Honourable Horn. I would just like to know, in answering that question, does the Office of the Public Protector consider themselves bound by a fair process?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to know about these rules, because they were published in the Government Gazette in 29 November 2010 and presented on the 4th Parliament. Portfolio Committee on the 27th February 2012. We are now in the 5th Parliament. The question is, are they applying these rules at present, 5th Parliament, or not? Because why I'm saying so, because the Section 9 of the Public Protector Act it explains about the investigation and the period of the days for the investigation. So, but I want to base my argument on the issue raised on 17 April 2018 about keeping complaints informed. Are you keeping the complaints informed or not? Why I'm saying so, because I'm from Limpopo. There was a complaint about the former vendor pension fund where people, their pension were robbed, and you investigated and you give them on the 8th of March 2018 that their matter has been finalized. But are you keeping them informed or not? Because when we found on the ground, people are not informed. They are complaining that the actuaries have finished their work, everything is in our table, but you are not informing them. So I wanted to know from you, are you informing them in terms of these rules, which was tabled and gazetted in the 4th Parliament? Now we're in the 5th Parliament. Are you keeping the complainants informed or not? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable Horn, the Public Protector, and Honorable Breitenbach, the Public Protector follows the principles of fairness, because Section 7(9) of the Public Protector Act, in its own, is a process of giving an opportunity to the implicated party, an opportunity to respond to whatever the findings the Public Protector might come to a conclusion if the person is implicated. So definitely those principles are followed, and again, we've been applying the rules, Honorable Mulaudzi. In fact, we've been applying the Public Protector Act, and we developed the service standards and the investigation handbook and the service standard operating procedures internally to make sure that we are operational. Hence, again, Mr. van der Merwe, I indicated that you needed to just get me on the rules, the section which deals with the time frame we take, or we are compelled to respond to the complainant, which in terms of our guidelines, every 6 weeks we should be informing the complainant about the progress of their matter. And I must indicate that it's a struggle, Honorable Mulaudzi, for our investigators as well to move with that particular speed of making sure that every file they have, they inform complainants every 6 weeks, especially the matters which are taking longer. And the issue of Section 9 of the Private Protector Act deals with the issue of contempt, as Mr. van der Merwe has indicated, that that was also questioning how do we hold accountable the public servants who are in contempt of the Public Protector, especially on matters which we have issued a report or we have requested a response, or we have subpoenaed and they have not appeared before the Public Protector. But then that process is simplified, and it's for us. The rules are basically to inform everyone to know what are our service standards. The issue of vendor pension fund, they are kept informed, especially Mr. Tswanoli, because there's a group of them who lodged the complaint with the Public Protector. The report was issued. National Treasury and the Minister of Finance have met several times with them. I even invited the complainant, where they committed by then that by the end of December, the process would have been completed. The issue of actuaries is not on my side. It's one of the remedial action for Treasury to get the actuaries to compare the old vendor pension fund with the current GEPF files to determine all those people who were impacted or who were robbed so that they can be paid. I even went to Capricorn Radio where I informed members that, in fact, those pension fund, that Treasury, we are waiting on Treasury. The Public Protector, there's nothing we can do because Treasury also, they indicated that they were let down by the company which they appointed to conduct the actuary process, but then they are still on track. And another problem was that there is another group which took Treasury to court, and that group is also delaying the process because Treasury was expected to respond now to court about the very same thing which we are busy with in processing the payments. So the Public Protector is not going to pay, but it's Treasury after they've compared the records from the old vendor to the current, and when the people were misled by the then officials to take their monies from the vendor pension fund and invest in the Sanlam pension fund. So that is happening. Every time we receive an update from Treasury, we do inform Mr. Chiololi because he is the complainant in our office. I know he might expect us to... We don't have any solution to this matter until Treasury determine how much to pay. And apparently it's receiving threats.
You have answered.
Yes.
Honourable members, consultations within government take long, and there are people who challenge government decisions, and it takes long for the courts to hand down judgment. And also one can ask if the Office of Public Protector has to report to complainants within 6 weeks. Is that reasonable or not, given the load of work and so on? I think these are challenges that we cannot deal with here. And now, if there are rules that have been made and there's a law that is enacted after that, it's a question of aligning those rules with the law that was subsequently made. And we have heard from Mr. van der Merwe of the challenges and things like that. So we can just note that there are challenges, but this committee cannot deal with those challenges of when do we align the court judgment with the subsequent legislation and things like that. But also the former public protector and the current public protector and other stakeholders agreed with us that we also need to review the Public Protectors Act. Ourselves as Parliament, we have not done that. So it means that there is a responsibility on us as well to do our work. So I don't think we can take these matters any further. Are there any questions? Honourable Mutapu.
Item 3, dealing with legal assistance. Yes. Legal assistance. Okay, thank you. Legal assistance during investigation. PP, is it not a duplication? Because previously there was a governance board, a structure within the office, which was offering pro bono services. So is it not going to be a duplication of some kind?
Thank you, Honorable Mutap. This legal assistance refers to the state institutions and even members of the executive, when they are in, called in by the Public Protector. In terms of the Public Protector Act, it does indicate that they do have the opportunity to bring their legal advisors or even attorneys and advocates to assist them, not to defend them, but just to be there to assist them during the process. And that pro bono services consultants were not legally qualified, and I think we will discuss them possibly when... But they were not legally qualified, all of them, and they were just doing the advice on other strategic issues, I think, by the former public protector. But this refers to when we are investigating you, we've subpoenaed you, you bring a firm of attorneys or an advocate to be with you. They are not defending you and they can't speak on your behalf. They are just there to make sure that the processes are fair.
I think this does not really, it's not really your business, but it should be a matter of grave concern that regulations made in 2010 by the fourth parliament are tabled in the fifth parliament, which means it takes 8 years, and then we sit here to approve regulations which were dealt with by another parliament. So it means there's something wrong in the system that has nothing to do with you. And I think ourselves as public representatives, we really have to get our act together as to whether these rules which were approved by another parliament, whether they shouldn't be, maybe even the minister was a different minister then, whether the new minister should not revisit those rules before they are brought to Parliament for tabling and by ourselves. So these are not the things that we could be putting questions to you about. Is a systematic problem that has nothing to do with you. I think in my view, you have satisfactorily dealt with the issues that have been raised. And also, we are not required to approve the rules. I think you have answered all the questions satisfactorily. That's why there are no further questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll also allow the CEO to take it through, and then I'll add after the presentation.
Okay, thanks. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. The policy here is about the appointment of a special advisor. The need for a special advisor, that will be my first slide. In terms of the Public Finance Management Act, the Public Protector is the executive authority of the institution. Therefore, the Public Protector is expected to deal with complex issues that are brought to her attention and to give strategic direction. To do that effectively, she requires access to high-level specialists and advice. Such expert advice may not be readily available in the institution, hence the need to appoint a special advisor. Section 3.1c of the Public Protector Act provides for appointment of staff by the Public Protector to enable her to perform her functions. Since special advisors are prerogative of the Public Protector, they will not be appointed through the normal recruitment and selection process, but special advisors are appointed as and when required to advise the PP on the specific issues. So they are not treated the same as a normal staff complement of the organization. The legislative provisions that guide this is again section 3.1c of the Public Protector Act. And then to give effect to this section, a policy or determination on the appointment of a special advisor was developed to determine the conditions of service and remuneration level in accordance with section 3.9 of the Public Protector Act. Outside the scope of the normal dispensation and determination for the staff members, as the special advisor position does not report to the CEO, but it reports directly to the private office of the public protector. Therefore, policy was benchmarked with the public service ministerial determination, providing for the dispensation for the appointment and remuneration of persons or special advisors appointed to the executive authorities. As such, that is the prescript referring to the special advisor. So we had to look at what the public service ministerial determination talks to for us to arrive at this determination. The role of the special advisor, the role is as follows, to advise the public protector on the exercise and performance of her powers, also to advise the public protector on the development of policy that will promote Public Protector South Africa objectives, to perform other tasks as may be appropriate in respect of exercise or performance of public protector powers and duties. A special advisor, therefore, was currently appointed for 3 months contract. That was from the 1st of April 2018 to June 2018. The current person is a well-qualified and experienced, but we're mainly talking about the process and the policy, how this determination was done. The determination within the Public Protector Office are always done in consultation with the Minister of Finance as per Section 10. Therefore, this consultation was also done. That determination be tabled also at the National Assembly, and it was submitted to the National Assembly also for tabling. So that process was done. This is just a repetition of what has happened since the policy was done, the appointment of this person for 3 months, yeah, and the qualifications therefore that goes with the appointment thereof. So it's basically a short policy that was developed for this aspect.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the briefing. I understand there is a 3-month contract. Is the contract renewable? And in view of the budgetary constraints that the Public Protector's Office is suffering under, where did the budget come from? And what was the cost of the contract for 3 months? And can I just ask whether it was not more advisable to rather appoint someone to the legal services, given that you say in your presentation on the second last page that the legal services is seriously undercapacitated? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I thought this special advisor must be appointed in terms of the Act itself. So the presenter here told us about the Section 3.1c. Section 3.1c talks about the appointment of staff, not the appointment of the Public Protector Special Advisors. So it means were being misled here, because they said Section 31C of the Public Protector Act provides for such appointments. The appointments we're talking about here is for the special advisor, it's not for a member of staff, as per Section 131C. So we find out that they said they benchmark with the appointment of the special advisors of the executive, which are ministers and presidents. So when they benchmark in terms of which legislation, which gives them authority to benchmark as such. So they said the special advisor is a very well qualified, well experienced in various fields of expertise. Can we be told in this committee about the candidate who's already on advising our public protector about his or her qualification and experience, which make it necessary to be appointed even outside of the legislation?
You're saying the legislation doesn't provide for the appointment of advisors?
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, whose fault is that?
That's what I want to be clear about that. So they said Section 311A requires that such determination to be tabled in the National Assembly, and it was submitted to the National Assembly for tabling. Which National Assembly? Our current National Assembly, and they, according to the presentation, they said it's going to expire in 3 months, which is the end of June. So are we going to table this to the National Assembly to discuss something already done to be tabled in the National Assembly? Is it a fair process to the members of the community, to the South Africans?
When during our terms of office we don't finish the business of Parliament, we leave this to the next Parliament, are we not contributing to confusion ourselves as members of Parliament? But that's not for you. I'm
yeah.
just putting
correct.
The question.
Correct, Chairperson.
Yes, Honourable Redenburg.
Thank you. I would like to know from, and clearly the CEO is the person dealing with these presentations, so one wonders why he couldn't have come and done it last week. But leaving that aside, he's done all the presenting, so he could have probably answered the questions as well. I'd like to know why it is necessary to have a new policy regarding the special advisor in your office, and in terms of which sections precisely you've done this. I'd like to know on what authority you made the determination regarding the remuneration and conditions of service of your special advisor, and in terms of which section. I'd like to know when and where the Minister of Finance was consulted with regards to this policy as required by your Act. I'd like to know what the response of the Minister of Finance was, and when consensus was reached with regards to the contents of this document. And I'm sure that you'll agree that by consultation, in the sense that it's set out in your Act, requires consensus, in the same way that a special director in the National Prosecuting Authority is required to consult with the director of public prosecutions in whose area is operating. It requires consensus, otherwise there's no point. I'd like to know when that consensus was reached, please, and whether the consensus was expressed in writing, and if so, perhaps you could produce that. I'd like to know what special skills the incumbent special director, special advisor possesses as qualifying this for this position. It's common knowledge that he's a property lawyer, So what special skills does he possess that qualify for this particular position? The position being reasonably narrowly circumscribed. Also, on what scale the special director has been appointed and why? I'd like to know precisely what role the special director plays in the office of the Office of the Public Protector. Does he have a security clearance? And if so, at what level? And when was it obtained? I'd like to know if the special advisor has any involvement in the writing of reports. And if so, which reports? And I'd also like to know who is in charge of the quality control of reports that leave the office. Thank you.
Can you help maybe for our purposes make us understand? I know that in law you consult, you take decisions in consultation, or you consult and decide. Now, I'm hearing for the first time that consultation requires consensus. I just want to be educated on that because I'm not aware of any legal requirements of that nature.
The Act is very clear. Section 310 says, in exercising his or her powers in terms of subsections 1 and 9, the public protector shall consult with the Minister of Finance. Now, that consult has been found in many cases, and I'm sure you're aware of all of them, to mean consensus. It doesn't mean inform. It means reach some sort of meeting of the minds. Similar to the situation where a special director in the National Prosecuting Authority has to consult with a director of public prosecutions when he wants to action matters in his area of jurisdiction. He can't send him a letter and say, I've informed you. There's lots of case law that says that requires a meeting of the minds, some sort of consensus, some basic togetherness on the issue. It's not just sending a letter and saying, this is what I'm going to be doing. That is not what the Act requires.
The public protector, when she referred to compliance with legality, she cited a court decision. And you are saying there are many court decisions, which means you can't give us the authority.
Oh, I'll find them for you. There are plenty. There
are plenty. So do you want us to act on the basis that there are plenty of case law?
Well, I assume that we're all lawyers here and we're all aware of the case law. But if we're not, I'll get it for you.
Let's leave it there.
But my debate is not with you. My question is directed to the public sector.
Yeah, but I, as the chair, have the responsibility to make sure that fair questions are put. Honourable...
You also have a responsibility to disseminate correspondence to this committee, which you don't do.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you, Honourable Members. Public Protector, media.
Honourable Tabo, that's why I say, as this committee, we have established that there is a need to review the Public Protector's legislation so that it is clear. Because we have not done the work ourselves, now anybody can interpret the legislation as they please, and that's not how justice should work. So we should go back and say, when are we reviewing this legislation? Because law presupposes certainty. Honorable Mutapu.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I personally would love to see this office doing its work within the parameters of the law and the Constitution. Okay, the Constitution. And
therefore, I've seen elsewhere where it is said the public protector has is within her or his powers may appoint a high-level specialist for the efficient functioning of the office. However, as my colleagues have mentioned, may the public protector then also clarify as to the exact legislation which was used, because in the Public Protector Act, Chairperson, it's referring specifically to such other staff. I forgot that subsection. Such other staff. Being staff, it means it should be part of the organogram. And then in this case, in Public Protector's presentation, it is said the special advisor shall not be part of staff. There is a deviation, isn't it? So we need to have clarity, at least specific legislation, because the enabling legislation is the Public Protector Act, which I will later refer to as PPA, and the Constitution, Section 81, and so forth. So clarity is sought in that regard. The security clearance issue, in terms of the presentation, it is said 30 days after such appointment.
Special advisor fall under the definition of staff?
In terms of public protector, it doesn't. It doesn't. But the Public Protector Act is saying such other staff. Yes. The legislation is saying such other staff. Then the presentation, the policy, my sincere apology, the policy which is tabled before, which is presented before us here, is saying it's not part of staff. There is a deviation. Yes. So another thing is my concern in relation to security clearance, because you say 30 days after such appointment. And my question is, then is that special advisor or the incumbent as of now able to have access to the classified documents without having obtained such clearance, security clearance? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Agus Kosana.
Yeah, no, thanks, Honorable Chair. Yeah, the policy states that the remuneration will be at the level of executive management. But also, it also states that such remuneration is negotiable between the PP and the special advisor. So is that not contradictory? When it says it should be at the executive manager level, but on the other hand, it also says it is negotiable. Two, on the issue of the 30 days, that the policy provides that the candidate for appointment of special advisors will be subjected to a security clearance within 30 days. Well, it does not say after 30 days, it says within 30 days. But within 30 days of assuming duties. But is it not appropriate, I think, for any vetting process to occur prior to such an appointment? Unlike to say within 30 days of assuming duties, is it not appropriate for that vetting to take place prior the appointment of such an incumbent? My third question is, I'm wondering as to how will this expenditure be reported on the annual financial statement, given the normal recruitment and or supply chain management process, as I think it is indicated that this process is the normal recruitment and the normal supply chain management process will not apply in the appointment of the special advisor. So in terms of the expenditure, how will that be reported on the annual financial statement in as far as the remuneration of that particular incumbent is concerned? I think the other question other members have covered it. Thanks.
Honorable Horn.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I'm largely covered specifically by the Honorable Mutapu. because I also wanted to raise the question that one can't, on the one hand, rely on the provisions in the Public Protector Act talking about a staff establishment, and then say that the special advisor is not to form part of the staff establishment. That is tautological and nonsensical. But Chair, allow me to
nonsensical. Is that arising from the Act itself or from the activities of the Public Protector?
I think what is to be addressed is that one cannot rely on the provisions of the Public Protector Act, which talk about how you go about establishing a staff component or establishment and informing the National Assembly of the way you went about setting up your staff establishment, and in the very next moment determine that a specific member of staff will not be deemed to be a member of staff. And if you'll allow me to continue as to my real question, I think it will become clear why this is relevant. Because, Chair, this goes about the whole issue of the executive authority. So what we have in South Africa is that in terms of the Public Service Act, members of the executive of the country is allowed to appoint special advisors who do not form part of staff establishment, so they do not contribute necessarily to the government employee pension fund. And there is a policy to which ministers must adhere when they appoint their own special advisors. So the question begs now, to what extent the Public Protector borrowed from this policy, and therefore when the PFMA determines that she, for the purposes of handling money coming from the public purse, is the executive authority of the Public Protector institution, office, whether she then sees herself also as more or less equal to members of the executive authority of the country, who are then allowed to appoint special advisors in terms of the Public Service Act, because that in itself would be problematic. Thank you.
Shouldn't we ourselves make a law which doesn't force the Public Protector to see herself as the same as executive members? Isn't the first mistake ourselves who made the law that forces her to see herself as the executive authority or something like that? Eh? Okay, anyway, let me allow her to answer, but we are the lawmakers. We must make the laws that do not create problems for the people that are appointed to run institutions supporting democracy. PP, proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Honourable Members. In dealing with the questions, I'll respond to individual Honourable Members. Honourable Swart, the contract is not renewable for now, because when the process of consultation was done with the Minister of Finance, hence the contract was only done for 3 months. It was accommodating the process which this particular consultation or as well the tabling could take place. The issue of the budget constraints is noted, and again the issue of not appointing for a long-term contract. I indicated the last time that there were savings in the post of the CEO, and the then acting CEO was not receiving any remuneration as far as that is concerned. So the savings from that particular in the compensation of employees was utilized for that particular purpose, because the CEO vacated the office in December 2017. So that was the consideration which I had to take into consideration when the policy was developed. The issue of the Mr. Mulaudz, the Public Protector Act, which policy did I utilize? For me, it's a matter of interpretation. I think I'll also deal with what Honorable Mutapo was saying, whether I'm saying the staff, as is mentioned in the PP, Public Protector Act, any contract worker, any because that special advisor is appointed as a contract worker, because that has we've signed a contract for 3 months with all those conditions of a contract. Therefore, it's a matter of interpretation whether you don't regard that as a staff. And when mentioning in the policy that he's not a staff, who is reporting to the CEO, and the internal recruitment policy doesn't apply to that particular person. So it was explaining, in fact, the policy was saying the recruitment policy of the PPSA, which policy goes through the consultation with the union, the bargaining forum, that policy is not applicable to the special advisor or to the private office of the public protector. Hence the creation of the policy to make sure that it's dealt with in that particular aspect. So the benchmarking, it was only benchmarking. It was not taking, because already there's something which is developed. And instead of starting afresh again, what the chairperson is saying, when the laws were made, was this institution not supposed to be having something like that to be able to perform their function? Yes, the legislation is quiet and clear and not clear in that particular aspect. But again, the Public Protector Act, it does indicate that the public protector, within her discretion or her control, will be able to appoint staff who will be able to assist in the performance of her functions. And the various fields of expertise which this person is having, the person is legally qualified, is an admitted attorney, yes, a conveyancer, and has some qualifications in banking law. But again, it goes further, Honorable Breitenbach, because you are asking, you are aware that he's a conveyancer by qualification. But the special skills goes further again into socio-political issues from this particular person, especially from the heterodox and mainstream perspective, issues relating to economic transformation and the theory of class. Because especially again on this matter, which one was expected to deal with the APSA appeal and the APSA petitioning of the SCA, that particular expertise assisted to work with the legal services. Within legal services, we do have a senior manager, legal services, who's like any other corporate person who deals with the issues of litigation and stuff like that, and within the legal prescripts. So this capacity was assisting to beef up within the legal services. And again, I must indicate that he worked for more than 7 years as a executive manager, corporate services in one of the parks board. And then the issue of consultation, chairperson, in terms of the Public Protector Act, it indicates that the Public Protector shall consult with the Minister of Finance. I must indicate that process was taken into account. The Minister of Finance, I wrote a letter to Minister of Finance with that consultation in February, 23 February. And then it only took, I think, until April the 18th when there was request for clarification from one of the officials of Treasury to my PA. And I responded. Then that matter was quiet until I received a response from the Minister of Treasury, which was dated the 6th of June, and where the minister was noting my letter And the minister commented by saying that he cannot support the issue of the policy. Maybe let me consult afresh as far as that is concerned. So I responded to the minister. I responded to the minister where I was clarifying that pursuant to the letter, in fact, to the consultation in terms of Section 310 of the Public Protector, to which the letter was responding to, I was indicating that I wrote, in fact, not 22 March 2018, and I also reminded him that the office, his office, requested clarification in April 2018. Then I clarified to him that a consultation, and it's a consultation, and it also provides that in 14 days I need to table the determination or send it to the national, table it before the National Assembly. So such process was also instituted, considering the delay by the Minister of Finance, because there was no response in this particular issue. And then my view is that consultation should be based on an approved policy, because he was proposing that that policy should be withdrawn, and of which the consultation was more on the determination as the Minister of Finance, because I also reminded him that when we are dealing with the issue of structure, and I attached one letter from the former Minister of Finance, Malusi Gigaba, where we were indicating about the changes to our structure, and the minister indicated that we support your structure, but I mean, reminding on the issue of the financial constraints. So the consultation with Minister of Finance was based more on the determination. And further, the issue of determination by the National Assembly, the letter was written to the Honorable Speaker, Mbete, and we have the copy of that particular letter, especially on that particular consultation. And the policy was tabled accordingly. And since there was no response also as far as that matter is concerned, the consultation was, in fact, the appointment was also based on the need to deal with this issue of responses to the process of appeal and the litigation which is before court. So previously, the consultation about the organizational structure of our office took place with the former minister. I was indicating to him, and the response was only concerned about the financial implications of the organizational structure. Accordingly, it is my considered view that the policy and anything done under it should only, in fact, the comment which the determination is expected from National Assembly, it's more on the compensation. Why I decided on level 14. If the National Assembly feels it's not supposed to be level 14, I think that's where the determination, because even the Public Protector Act is very clear in Section 311 B and C, where it indicates beyond doubt that the function of the Public Protector cannot be halted whilst waiting for the processes to unfold. So that was done in terms of that understanding, Chairperson. And on the issue of the security clearance, I think that was saying within 30 days, of which the forms have been completed, though the delays in processing the security clearance by SSA, that is not yet done, or that is not yet being processed, but then the forms have been completed. The reports, this person has nothing to do with the reports, it's nothing to do with the quality assurance of the report. This person only deals with the issues of advices, especially on decisions to take as far as the issues which I've indicated. And Honorable Mutapa, I think I've dealt with the issues. The person doesn't deal with classified information, deals with the advices where we deliberate on matters, on issues of litigation, which after drafting the answering affidavit is a matter of a public document. And Honorable Skosana, the expenditure, how it's going to be reported, as I indicated that we used the savings from the compensation of staff. And it's not only the CEO post which is vacant, it's also the other vacant positions which have been vacated by some of the senior investigators. So it will be used, it will use that particular process. I'm done, Chairperson.
Honorable members, with due respect to ourselves, when the laws are ambiguous, then we're going to be in the situation we find ourselves in. And the responsibility to make laws that are certain is the responsibility of Parliament, not those who implement the laws. And when the laws are silent, they make people to take the law into their hands, because the law is silent. So let's not make ambiguous laws, let's not make laws that are silent. Now, if people have got to be consulted, they take time to make decisions. What do we expect people that must do their work do? So a whole system has got to function well and not let other people down. And if we want people to vet before appointing, the law must say before a person is appointed, that person must be vetted. And if we say the vetting must be within 30 days, do we mean that you appoint first and vet later? That is the duty of the lawmakers to do. So let's not, as lawmakers, create problems for ourselves by making laws which are not clear, which are ambiguous, which are not certain. We have to make sure that we make laws that don't create problems for people who have got to run the state affairs. Thank you, Honorable Britton, but you still have something to say.
Thank you.
Honorable Horn and Honorable Mutab.
I may have misunderstood, and so please correct me if I'm wrong. The policy on the appointment of the special advisor was signed by yourself on the 14th of February 2018, is that correct? And the implementation and effective date of the policy is the same date. Yet the minister was only consulted as required by the Act in March. I'm not sure how that comes about, that the policy is effective before the required consultation takes place. If you could just help me clear that up, please. And then the Act makes provision for, or the rules make provision for the special advisor to have security clearance, and you say the forms have been filled in, but state security is dragging their feet. That's probably because they're too busy implementing an electronic case management system. But the deputy public protector is precluded from functioning in your office and doing his job because you have an issue with his security clearance, yet your security advisor or your special advisor has free rein with no security clearance. Could you clear that up for me, please? Bearing in mind that your deputy has been in that office for many years and has dealt with many top secret matters.
The Queen can go before me. Chair, I'll go. I think there is now a statement in answering regarding the whole issue of the policy and key special advisor that I think leads only to more confusion. As I said in my previous unanswered question, there's this whole issue of what is the status of the executive authority. But in her responses, the public protector now also says that actually none of the provisions regarding staff is applicable to what she called the private office of the public protector. So I don't know what this private office is now also. If she could clarify that to us and why she would feel that the relevant legislation and prescripts in respect of staff would not be applicable to people within, if there is a private office of the public protector. But then secondly, Chair, she also in dealing with the qualifications and the expertise of this current special advisor said that he's well versed in issues of socio-economic matters, theory of class, and therefore he was needed to assist with the petitioning of the SCA and the APSA matter. But that needs to be unpacked as well, because the only information this committee has on record was that the public protector previously informed us that she would only be appealing the personal cost order, the 15% personal cost order. It is a matter of public record that that appeal was not successful, and obviously that may then need a petition to the SCA to reverse the 15% cost order. What I fail to understand is why, if the public protector is not appealing the merits of these judgments, why she will need a specialist in respect of socioeconomic matters and theories of class, because that goes to the merits and her whole arguing when she ordered the mandate of the Reserve Bank to be amended. And if she's not appealing that, why then do you need a specialist advisor in respect of these issues? Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, let me repeat myself. This is a very important Chapter 9 institution, which is the protector of our indigents, our have-nots, our grassroots, especially our rural people who cannot afford legal fees. However, I humbly plead with you, Chairperson, and the Office of Public Protector that whatever is being done in this office should be done within parameters of the law. If you read Section 31C, Chairperson, of Public Protector Act, it provides that the public protector shall, subject to his or her directions or control in the performance of his or her functions under this Act and the Constitution, be assisted by, I go to subsection C, such staff seconded in terms of subsection 12 or appointed by the public protector as may be necessary to enable the public protector to perform his or her functions, such staff. Then it said the public protector act and constitution. I now go to constitution section 182 subsection 2. The public protector has the additional powers and functions prescribed by national legislation. National legislation in this regard, Chairperson, is referring to the enabling legislation, which is the Public Protector Act, nothing else. Thank you. It's not ambiguous, because it's saying 31C is clear. Such other staff. Therefore, staff, it will be within the organogram of that. It's not, because the public protector is saying is a matter of interpretation. But this is very clear according to me.
You are helping this committee, Honorable Mutapu.
Thank you.
Because you refer to the Constitution, you refer to legislation, and then that makes it easier for the chair to understand what we're talking about, and it will make it easier for the public protector to respond. That's why I say we mustn't just generalize and track things from the thumb. Honorable Honorable Mulwana, Honorable Skosana, Honorable Lanz.
No, I just want a clarification from Honorable Mutap on a certain matter. I thought that when you say staff, you mean people that in the employ, whether permanent or temporary, of a particular organization. Others who are permanent are normally in the organogram, and others that are temporal are sometimes not in the organogram.
With respect, are you not out of order? You are asking a question to a member.
Thanks, Chair. Well, just a follow up on my last question. I don't think it was well captured. My question was, how will this expenditure in terms of the remuneration of the special advisor be reported in the annual financial statement? It was not about the resources. It was the response of the public protector. I think she thought I was asking about where are you going to get money. I think I well understood that we are going to use money from other savings, the savings from other posts, to remunerate the incumbent. But my question was on how are we going to report that in the annual financial statement, given the fact that the incumbent is not going to be, he or she is not going to be part of the staff, and that there will be no reporting line between the special advisor and the accounting officer. So how are you going to report that in the annual financial statement? Because I think every expenditure of any institution should be reported in the annual financial statement.
Honorable Sosana, you were called, I don't know, by nature or by somebody when the question was answered.
No, this one, when it was answered, I was here already.
May I ask Kukuni Marute? Honorable Marute.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to know from the public protector about the using of Section 12A of the Public Service Act in terms of benchmarking to develop the policy, and what informs them to do that, and again also to ask whether Section 12A of the Public Service Act also applies to any Chapter 9 institution. And lastly, it's about the recent newspaper article about you removing or disbanding the Government Advisory Board, which was a pro bono to assist you, which was helping a lot to the previous public protector to give the information, while you said that there is a financial, extreme financial constraint which is affect negatively to your operations, and hence you remove the pro bono groups which were helping you, and appoint a special advisor who will be paid, while you said that there is a problem of financial muscles in the institution. So I wanted to know, comparing to what you decided to disband, the pro bono advisory government advisory board in state, and you appoint the advisory person. Thank you.
Maybe you should have added whether or not pro bono people get vetted, and if not, whether or not that system cannot be used to infiltrate the office and gain access to information that they should not gain access to. Honorable Short.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Public Protector. Maybe the CEO could just respond to the one outstanding question about the cost of the three-month contract. And then I'm trying to understand the role. Is this tabled for our information, Chair? Because if it is a determination in terms of Section 31C, and I see the word determination is referred to in the proposal, then in terms of Section 39, which refers to all appointments in terms of subsection 1B or C, which is the one we're dealing with, that the National Assembly has, and I need to understand myself, but under 11B, that the National Assembly can disapprove of any determination. I would read that to mean that this means that we can either approve or disapprove this determination, because it is a determination referred to in terms of 31B or C, and that is the purpose of one of the other purposes of this exercise. There's a specific power there. Thank you, Chair. If I'm reading it correctly, I stand under correction.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the Honourable on the issue of the status of the executive, as the presentation we've said that the executive office of the Public Protector, the people who are linked to my term of contract, because I've discovered that some of the officials will find that they were appointed by the previous public protectors, but now when they leave or when they are brought, especially the PA, the spokesperson, and the chief of staff, their term should be tied to the public protector. And when they leave, so that they are not creating a burden to the structure of the organization if they don't have post within that particular structure. And on the issue of the APSA personal cost, in fact, I should have added as well that the special advisor, we are working very closely on the issue of the Vision 2023, which I've presented to the committee on making sure that we reach out to the grassroots and the strategies which we can use in that particular aspect. So the petitioning of the Supreme Court of Appeal, yes, it's the order of 4.3 on personal cost order, and the application, the appeal to the Constitutional Court on direct access to the appeal court, to the Constitutional Court. And I need to indicate that the court acquire found that I was having some reasonable suspicion of bias, and which led to this. And that has a bearing on all the findings, because then the findings led to that particular court order. Therefore, it will be dealt with. In fact, we've also filed the relevant affidavits to that aspect, and it's very clear it deals with everything which had to in that judgment of the court accord. Honorable Mutapo, I think that's why I was also saying that the staff for me is both the contract and full-time employed staff of the Public Protector, as I've explained. And Honorable Skosana, I think the CEO will also add, but that will be reported on the AFS on contractors, because we have the savings we've used the under the compensation of employees, so we will report it there under contractors, but the CEO will add as far as that is concerned. Honorable Mulawuzi, No, we were not using the public service. The Public Protector, in terms of the Public Protector Act, can determine the conditions of service. So it's a question of benchmarking. Again, not having the resources to appoint specialists to advise on this. Therefore, it was just checking what documents are there in the public service. And I must indicate that even now, I've mentioned the last meeting of April, we've approached the Department of Public Service and Administration. They have the capability, the specialist, to determine the service model, the delivery models and the issue of saying, with the structure which we are having, can we streamline and be able to deliver services? Because we felt we won't have an opportunity to receive additional budget to employ more staff. So we are trying to innovate and do that. Instead of appointing private consultants, hence we are using government, because at any rate we are an organ of state which is there to strengthen constitutional democracy. And on the issue of the board which was there, I was told when I started, met with one of the board members, and by then the then CEO and the leadership of the organization, we agreed that we wouldn't be using the board. And I must indicate as well that the board, they are not legally qualified unless one of them, I think, and I don't know what they were advising the former public protector on. And again, it was depending on her need at that particular time. So I think it depends on whether one would need those expertise. So I then the agreement was taken to dissolve that board. On the Honorable Suar, do you ask the CEO? Before the CEO answers, on the determination, Honorable Suar, is true. The way the Public Protector Act reads, again, if we had an efficient system, it's we wouldn't reach a situation, because the way it's captured here, it says that determination, because it relates to the determination, a document setting out remuneration, allowances and conditions of employment, because by sending the policy, it was only for National Assembly and the Minister of Finance to check on the determination part. So it says then, if the National Assembly disapproves of any determination, not the policy, but the determination in the policy, such determinations shall cease to be of force to the extent to which it is so disapproved. If the determination ceases to be of force as contemplated in paragraph B, anything done in terms of such determination up to the date on which such determination ceases to be in force shall be deemed to have been done validly, and any right, privilege, obligation or liability acquired, accrued or incurred up to the said date under and by virtue of such determination shall lapse upon the said date.
You say as we sit here there is a determination?
Not, that's the thing, Chairperson, because after when sending that letter to the Speaker, this is the determination which I'm requiring to determine whether in that policy dealing with remuneration is the determination of putting that special advisor at level 14 fine, or that determination possibly that person doesn't need to be at level 14 or level 10, 12.
Wouldn't you agree that it's premature for us to decide to approve this policy as we sit here?
Chairperson, I think I was clarifying that I think by sending the letter to the Speaker, possibly that deliberations were supposed to happen then. I'm not saying possibly we'll decide here, but it was more on a determination of the remuneration, allowances and other conditions of employment of this particular person.
Through no fault of yours, through no fault of yours, it appears to me that we may be approving something that is irregular. As I say, you are being let down by other institutions of government. But should we, as this committee, overlook the fact that you have been let down and approved? Or should we give you an opportunity to await those other institutions to do the necessary so that we, all of us, are on the side of the law?
Chairperson, willing to receive a response after I've submitted the request for in fact, Minister of Finance has responded. I've corresponded with him and I requested a meeting as well so that we can clarify, and then I get an official response as far as that is concerned on the determination. And then the portfolio committee as well can guide or can also indicate whether you will respond to me in writing, especially because the speaker has referred this matter to the committee, especially on the issue of the determination, whether what Honorable Swart asked, whether in your own committee deliberations, you can then respond to that particular issue in writing.
Honorable members, I said when we started that I am concerned about how matters are processed. It's not the public protector alone who processes matters. There are other institutions of government that must process matters. And if they don't do the necessary on time, that is going to affect her office. Now the question is, as we sit here as the committee, should we overlook the fact that things were not properly processed and approved for convenience, or what should we do, or should we give them an opportunity to do what they ought to do? Honorable Mutabu.
I don't think we have the necessary information to can enable us to approve or disapprove. So let's put this matter in abeyance until we have the necessary information. Like issue of conferring with our sister portfolio committee of public service and administration and others, with due respect.
You saw my hand long ago, you just chose not to give me an opportunity. And none of my questions were answered in the follow-up. I'd like my follow-up questions answered, please. Thank you.
I thought what is at issue now, there are two things, which is the policy as well as determination on remuneration, unless I'm making a mistake. If it is the policy, a question of a policy in we can be accepted, this is a correct policy. The next thing is how much. That is not when you're doing auditing. What's crucial there is only that portion, which will be determined perhaps by the treasurer or whoever at the end. But the policy talks about you can do, we can get so and so, who can do A, B, C, and D, and stop. But for us, who how much that amount is now not our, even if we get that information. It's not going to, because what we're talking about is the policy yet. Our concern is the policy, not the actual amount. So I thought that because we're going to come back, say, in August here now, is it not better that in principle we say we accept it conditional upon the finalization of the amount?
I'm not sure that time constraints must make us take decisions which may be wrong. And also that if amongst ourselves we are not agreed, and the other people say that some questions have not been answered, and I've said it's not through the fault of the public protector, she has also been let down, and she is prepared to await the other institutions that have to inform our work, her work, to do their work. Why should we take decisions for convenience? Why should we, Honorable Horn, Swartz, can you assist us? Should we take decisions for convenience?
Chair, I think it's the engagement is helpful because I understand the policy and the determination. And Public Protector indicated she had written to the Speaker, she had written to the Minister of Finance. So to a certain degree, you are correct, Chair, that other people have let her down as well. And I don't think we can take a final decision until we've got all the information. I would like to know just the ballpark figure of what we're looking around for that three-month contract. But bear in mind, at the end of the day, it's academic because it ends at the end of this month, the three-month contract. But it will be important for her own purposes for us to assist in this process going forward. The policy of special advisors and then the determination as set out. And I'd just like to understand, so when you wrote to the Speaker, you were asking for a determination, is that correct? And separately, it was the policy here. And once we've got, is that, because I'm a bit confused thinking now. So we just need to understand the two silos to this part, and they are interrelated. So I tend to agree with you, Chair. We can't take a final decision today until we've got the inputs from the Speaker and other officials. But it is a matter of concern when other institutions do not assist when that is a matter that needs to be done. I mean, we set out in legislation certain time periods, and if that is not complied with by other institutions, then it is a matter of concern.
I respect the right of all members to speak, but we have run out of time, but we cannot condone something that is unlawful. Otherwise, this committee will be acting unlawfully. And therefore, I would rule that we can't take this matter any further. We must allow the public protector to go back to the people that are letting her down to do their work, because all of us who hold public office must do our work. So this brings this...
I like my questions answered.
It doesn't serve any purpose because we don't have time. I'm deciding now. We can't take this discussion any further because we have another matter that is on the table. And then this matter will come back to us, and then I will remind you of your question, and then you can
I'll remind you because
you are an honorable member of this committee. Thank you, Public Protector, for your appearance and for your presentation. Unfortunately, today we cannot approve this, but we will also assist you to intercede with the other institutions that are letting you down to make sure that they do their work. Can we take a 5 minutes break before we start another?